Undergraduate Mathematics Society has sponsored this lecture to explain about the solution of what is perhaps the oldest unsolved problem in mathematics. And I want to remind everyone that there's a reception following the lecture in the mathematics atrium, which is in the south atrium in that way. So I'd like to introduce to you Molly McMahon, the president of the Undergraduate Mathematics Society, who will introduce our colleague Tom Hale.
A few articles published in the last few months. Packing challenge mastered at last. U of M professor solves 400-year-old math riddle. Mathematics proves what the grocer always knew. Kepler's orange stacking problem squashed. Mathematician proves that shops know how to stack fruit. Hale solves the oldest problem in discrete geometry. Who would have thought that a mathematical proof could receive so much media coverage? Well, the coverage may be unusual, but it's far from undeserved. An expert in representation theory, analysis, algebra, and physics, Dr. Hales received his MS and BS degrees at Stanford in 1982, his PhD at Princeton in 86 under the Harold W. Dodds Honorific Fellowship. He then went on to the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute to do postdoctoral research, and then to Harvard, where he was an assistant professor for 2 years under the National Science Foundation Fellowship. He completed a postdoctoral research fellowship at the Institute for Advanced Study in the following year. He was an assistant professor at the University of Chicago from 1990 to 1993. In 93, he came to the University of Michigan as an associate professor. Here he's a member of the Math Department Executive Committee and chair of the Undergraduate Scholarship Committee. He has won the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts Excellence in Education Award and the Henry Russell Award for 1999. He's here today with the proof of a problem that has stumped mathematics for 400 years, a problem that seems simple at first glance. Examined more closely, one can see that a proof of such a problem actually involves over 5,000 possible spherical configurations, thousands of crucial details, 250 pages of formal proof, 150 variables combined into one equation, 10 years of work, 5-step strategy, 3 gigabytes of computer memory, a talented graduate student assistant, and one brilliant associate professor. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tom Hales.
Last week, the New York Times ran an article about mathematics. The title, Math Emerges Blinking into the Glare of the Pop World. This article describes a new booming market for popular math books. It quotes an editorial claiming that the present time is a golden age for popularization of mathematics. It attributes a surge in interest to mathematics to the British mathematician Andrew Wiles, who made mathematics headlines around the world for solving the most famous problem in the history of mathematics, Fermat's Last Theorem. This mathematical work was popularized by the science journalist Simon Singh, who wrote a popular book, Fermat's Last Theorem, and also produced a TV program on the subject that you might have seen. About 2 years ago, Andrew Wiles collected a prize of £30,000 for the solution to this old prize. This is a prize that was established in the 19th century. I personally have benefited enormously over the past year from this recent rise in interest in popular mathematics. Andrew Wiles collected his prize on June 27th, 1997. The next day, Simon Singh, the one who wrote the book about Andrew Wiles' work, wrote an article for the English science magazine, The New Scientist. But as it turns out, most of the article was not about the most famous problem in mathematics or its prize. Instead, the article opens with the words, with the most notorious problem in mathematics now solved, an even older puzzle is drawing the crowds. In that article, Simon Singh argues that a worthy successor for Fermat's last theorem must match its charm and allure. Kepler's sphere-packing problem is just such a problem. It looks simple at first sight, but it reveals its subtle horrors to those who try to solve it. Of course, I was delighted by the problem because this is the problem I've been working on for the last several years. I have no doubt that it's the exaggerations of a journalist trying to popularize a new problem, but I was pleased with the article. Simon Singh and I corresponded a few more times in August of 1998, last summer. I wrote him an email saying that I had a packet of papers that I wanted to send him. He wrote back saying, if this is what I think it is, I can have something in the news within 24 hours. And so I told him to go ahead with it, and he put it on BBC International Radio and the Daily Telegraph. So that was last August. Today, I'd like to talk about the solution to this problem in sphere packings, the Kepler conjecture. And I also want to talk about some related problems in geometry, many of them unsolved. I've tried to prepare a lecture that doesn't involve any complicated equations. Rather, I'm going to explain these different models that we have here, and by the end of the lecture, you should understand what each of these models is about and what they have to do with sphere packings. One of the remarkable aspects about this problem is how quickly you can move to research-level problems. In many fields, you have to talk as fast as you can talk for an hour using very advanced mathematics to get to the frontier of the subject. In this subject, it's quite different. I'll take as an illustration this last month's Orbit magazine. They have a column, Truther Than Strange, where it reports after 10 years of research, Thomas Hales, a professor at the University of Michigan, finally figured out that the best way to stack fruit is in a pyramid. And here's illustration of that configuration. This configuration of spheres, it's often called the cannonball arrangement because it's what you see at war memorials. It's also what you see at fruit stands. It fills about 74% of space. So 74% is the amount filled up by the cannonballs or the fruit or whatever it is that you're stacking. And then the holes in between the balls fills the remaining space. So if there's one number to remember today, it's the number 74%, because that's approximately how well this packing does. And the problem is to show that nothing can do any better. In the introduction, the complexity of the proof was described a bit. The fact that it takes a couple of months of computers running nonstop to check through all the possibilities. Let me say a bit about the publication of this paper. Last August I said I finished, but that's not at all the end of the process. Before it's accepted by the mathematical community, it needs to go through a long process of refereeing. I submit it to a journal, and referees check over it. The journal where I submitted it made the unusual move of organizing a workshop around this problem to orient the referees to the way this proof works. So there was a week-long workshop in Princeton in January where a number of experts were brought in, and halfway through the conference, the participants were deputized as referees. And I think there are 7 or 8 referees working on it. Another couple of people working on the computer aspects of the proof, and the hope is that sometime by about July, they'll be back with a verdict as to whether my argument is correct or not. So enough of that. Let's move to the frontier of mathematics. This is about how long it takes to move to an unsolved problem in mathematics. So here's an unsolved problem. I think think everybody will agree that this is the best way to stack tubes. At least, I bought these tubes at Home Depot, and this is how they were stacked. So unless an unemployed mathematician is working there, and it's solution. Let me show a couple of slides here. So here we have the fruit stand. Here's the tube problem. Show that the best packing of tubes are the same size as the honeycomb arrangement. This is called the honeycomb arrangement because you see that around each tube there are six other tubes, and you get a hexagonal structure that shows up in honeycombs. Let me move to a couple of misconceptions that you might see. So let me talk about this model now. What this model is it's taking the pyramid stacking and it's replacing all the spheres by points so that you just get the skeleton of the cannonball arrangement. And you see that it forms a pyramid. A lot of people think that since this is a pyramid, the pieces also are all pyramids or tetrahedra. But you start taking it apart, and sure enough, there are lots of pieces like that. But in the middle is this other type of piece that's hidden from view when you start out. Now this, if I put a sphere at each corner in this arrangement, I get an extremely good packing. But this piece hidden in the middle is an extremely poor packing. And I think one reason that people think that it's obvious that this is the best arrangement is that you just see these pieces when it's stacked together, and you don't notice that there's this big piece in the middle. It's a very poor type of arrangement. So the thing to remember about this is that there's this other type of piece hidden in the middle. Let me describe this particular arrangement. So this is what's called a tile. You have tiles that fill, say, the bathroom tiles that are two-dimensional. This is a three-dimensional tile. This is a piece, if I put these together, I can fill all of space by stacking one right next to another. And there's not very much known about packings in general, but one thing that you do know is that if you can completely fill space, that's the best you can do. And this completely fills space. And let me try to explain that. The best way to show you would be to have a whole collection of these and fill the room with these and show you that they fit together. But you can see it without actually having a lot of pieces. If you look straight on, you see a square. Okay. Now if we take here we have a number of squares, and you see that squares can be packed together to fill space. So I can put these pieces this way and make an array of squares like I have in the slide here, and they fit together, except you'll have something that looks sort of like an egg crate where it bumps up and down and up and down on the top level. But the peaks from one level will fit into the valleys of the next, and you can fill layer upon layer with these things to completely fill space. If you're not convinced by that, let me give you a second way of packing these. If I look at a different angle, you see a hexagon. There are six sides here to this figure. Okay, does everybody see that? And so I can pack those together side by side to fill a layer, and again, the peaks fit into the valleys, and you can fill space with these things packed one against the other. Okay, so what I want to explain is what these models have to do with the cannonball arrangement and sphere packings. What does this have to do with the cannonball arrangement? Well, if I put a cannonball in each box and then pack them and then take away the boxes, I'm left with the cannonball packing. Okay, so that's the significance of this shape. I put a cannonball in each one, then I fill space with the boxes and then take away the boxes and I'm left with the cannonball packing. So this is called a rhombic dodecahedron, but I think of it as a cannonball box. Kepler made the observation that the square does not exist without the triangle, and the triangle does not exist without a square in connection with close packings. And what he means is this observation that there are two ways to put together this arrangement. I can put it together as squares, or I can put it together as hexagons, which are made out of triangles. And those two arrangements exist side by side. Some people ask me, there are two types of pyramid arrangements, and which one is best? This one, I said, fills about 74% of space, but what about this one? Does it do better or is it worse? Well, Kepler's principle is that the triangle doesn't exist without the square without the triangle. This has a base that's a square, this has a base that's a triangle. But one does not exist without the other, and you find that you can put these two arrangements together and they fit together. One is really the same packing as the other, just viewed from a different angle. So you have the square packing and the triangular packing. They both give about 74% of space fill. Okay, let me a few more slides here. So I went through all my old photo albums, and most people come back from Africa with Kenya with pictures of elephants and giraffes. I come back with fruit. This is to show you that people really do pack fruit in this arrangement and market in Paris. I wanted to show this slide because of the artichokes. Shortly after the proof of Kepler's conjecture was announced, I started getting phone calls on my answering machine from Ann Arbor's farmer market saying that we know how to deal with oranges, but we're having trouble with artichokes anymore. It's just a piece of the cannonball arrangement. The thing to learn from this picture and this model, and this also is a piece of the cannonball arrangements where the balls have been made smaller so that you can see the structure. And you might have to come up afterwards to count, but if I take any one of these balls in the middle and I count how many neighboring balls that there are around it, the answer is always 12. And that's one way to recognize this structure, is that everyone always has 12 around it. And that's a characteristic property of these close packings. There's actually a number of ways to pack things with density 74%, but they all have this property that there are 12 around every one. And if you count, well, it's a little hard to count in this picture, but you see three here in front. And then there are six going around in a hexagon, and then there are three hidden in back, so that every one has 12 around it. I promised to say a word about applications of sphere packings. I don't know what applications there will be to my work, if any, but my work on sphere packings is just one small bit of a really big research endeavor. People have estimated there have been about 800 research articles written in the last 10 years on sphere packings and a related topic of error correcting codes. And an application not of my work particularly, but of the work of others, is to the relationship between sphere packings and error correcting codes. So I've got a slide here that illustrates how that works. At the top, I have a sphere packing. And in the end, we're going to get some binary information that's going to be useful for computers. So I take each sphere, it's a little dark. I've written in the positions of each of the spheres, but it's a little hard to see. So if we call this one point zero, I go over one unit, and that'll be position one. This will be over to position two. And so I look at each case at how far to the right the sphere is and how far up, and I get a pair of numbers describing the position of the center of that sphere. If I then look at those two numbers and ask whether those numbers are even or odd, and each time it's an even number, I'll write a zero, and each time it's an odd number, I'll write a one, I get, in this case, this array of numbers describing the parity of the centers of these things. So I get zeros or ones. And then I look at the list of all the possibilities that I have, and in this case, I either get 0, 0, or 1, 1. And that is a very, very simple example of what's called an error-correcting code. An error-correcting code is a binary sequence of numbers with a certain amount of redundancy built into it, so that if you lose the zero in transmission, you still have this other zero that tells you what it was that you were trying to transmit. Or if you lose one of the ones, then you still have another one that tells you what the information was. So you build redundancy into this code, and that's the error correcting property. And that's very useful whenever you have, you're trying to transmit binary information where there's noise, so that you lose part of the information. You can reconstruct the original binary input because of this error correcting property. In this case, we just repeat everything twice. But if you take more complicated sphere packings, and I mean really much more complicated sphere packings, you can get very interesting error correcting codes in this manner. And these are extremely useful in everything from modem design to encryption of data on compact disks. Okay, so this is just a bit of an outline of some of the topics that I want to cover. I've given an introduction, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, some more about these geometric models. I'm going to say a few words about why this problem is difficult to solve, and a few words about the solution, and then towards the end I'm going to talk about a second topic of foam. So here's Kepler. The history starts actually a little bit before Kepler with the mathematician Thomas Harriot, who was Walter Raleigh's mathematical assistant. And Walter Raleigh gave him the homework problem of calculating the number of cannonballs in piles for him. But this sparked Thomas Harriot's imagination. And he started thinking about not just cannonballs, but he started thinking about atoms and what the implications for an atomic theory would be. And he also started thinking about sphere packings, and he was thinking of these as atoms, more or less, and trying to understand nature through the possible arrangements that you can have for spheres. So this is Thomas Harriot. We are indebted to him in many ways. He invented the less than and greater than symbol. He popularized the equal sign. He was the first to use binary numbers. He popularized the atomic theory in Europe at the time, and he started the mathematical theory of sphere packings. So this is Harriot's solution to Walter Raleigh's problem. We start with one sphere at the top, and then one and one, and then we have one and one, and so we put two. We add the number of spheres above, and we get two. I have one and two, one plus two is three, so I put three here. I have two plus one, and I put below it three. In each case, I add the two numbers, three plus three gives six, one plus three gives four, three plus one gives four. So he built up a big triangle in this way that gives the number of spheres in a packing. And so here we see a very small cannonball stack. We'd have to extend it on down to get interesting formulas. But this triangle, he was doing this long before Pascal, but this is called Pascal's triangle. And so Pascal's triangle gives the solution to this problem of counting cannonballs in a stack. Here's Kepler's book. He wrote a book after corresponding with Harriot for a while. Harriot kept telling Kepler that he needed to adopt an atomic theory to understand optics properly. And Kepler didn't believe in the atomic theory, and he kept saying no, and Harriot kept writing back and insisting that he should study the atomic theory. And finally he did in this book published in 1611. The question that Kepler asks in this booklet is, why six? Why does the number six keep popping up in nature in various places? For instance, he discusses the honeycomb, which is a six-sided arrangement. He discusses snowflakes. The title of the book is The Six-Colored Snowflake. Or you have naturally occurring crystals. Here's a big waterfall with hexagonal columns. Why does this hexagonal structure keep showing up again and again in nature? And the answer that he was considering was that it was some sort of crystallographic explanation or atomic theory, that somehow the fact that you can fit six tubes or six balls around one perfectly had something to do with the six that keeps showing up in places like this. So he didn't answer these questions to his satisfaction, but this book was extremely influential in crystallography for the next two centuries. So in this booklet, to try to understand this number six in an atomic sort of way, he starts making all sorts of sphere packings. And he makes this conjecture that the packing, meaning the cannonball packing, will be the tightest possible, so that in no other arrangement could more pellets be stuffed into the same container. People have worked on this problem for a long time. People haven't been able to prove this number 74%, but people have tried. The first results that I know of were from a mathematician named Blickfield in 1919, who showed that you can fill at most 88% of space. And then somebody else, and then he proved 83%, and then Rankin in 47 did 82%, and then Rogers in 55, 77.9%. And then there have been a few more small improvements since then. This problem took a very long time for me to solve. I had two big fears in working on a problem that would take a long time. The first is this, that I would find out after 37 years that I was trying the wrong approach. My other big fear was that when I was very close to a solution, a day away, a week away, a month away, somebody else would come along and say, I have discovered a truly remarkable way to solve this problem, and here it is in this paragraph. Well, that almost happened to me. I told you about this popular article that Simon Singh wrote about my research the day after Andrew Wiles collected his prize. Here's a picture from the article. The helicopters represent the computers that I used. I guess this is, one of these must be me, I don't know. One. And then these hills represent all possible sphere packings that you can imagine. And this computer technology is coming down with these linear hyperplanes to produce bounds on the density of packings. So a week after this article was published, I got an email from a mathematician at Oxford who said, I found a truly remarkable way to prove the Kepler conjecture. Our file formats weren't compatible, so it took about a week to find out what this idea was. But it turned out that the mathematician was proposing, let's see if I have, that you start with one sphere in the center, and then, as I said, you can fit 12 around it in a tight way like this. And then the idea is, well, this is the best thing you can do with 12 spheres around one. And then you do another layer, and you show that that's the best thing you can do. And then inductively, you build out this big sphere packing where you show that at every layer, this is the best possible solution. So I was quite relieved when I heard the strategy, because the strategy is completely wrong. For one thing, there's more than one way to pack 12 spheres around one in the center. So you'll have to look at this afterwards to see that these are really different. But there's more than one way to pack 12 spheres around one in the center. So this induction argument doesn't get going. But there are more serious problems. And that is, so here again I have 12 around one in the center, one on the top, one on the bottom, and then two rings of five in this arrangement. But they're not just a finite number of arrangements, but they're an infinite number. You can deform the spheres that touch the one in the center in such a way that the 12 spheres are touching at every moment. So there are infinitely many ways of getting these to touch. And the best way of arranging 12 around the one in the center is not the cannonball arrangement, as it turns out. There's a smaller box that you can make. So this is a smaller box than this box, but they hold a cannonball of exactly the same size. And a student of mine, Sean McLaughlin, he's an undergraduate here, he proved that this is the smallest possible box that you can build, not this. And so there's no way to start out. The problem is that these things don't fit together into good packings, but this and not the cannonball is the best way to start out, and this is the flaw of this Oxford mathematician's reasoning. So some people wondered, in fact, Newton wondered, this is a famous controversy, well, if there's so much room when you have 12, why can't you get 13 to fit around the one in the center? With these packages, you only have 12 around. So here I have an arrangement with 13 spheres fitting around the one in the center. There's one in the middle, and then I've got four here, and then the rest down here. I've got another model of it. Here is a model with 13. Let's see. So I've got one on the top, and then I've got three rings of four for a total of 13 touching the one in the center. And here's another picture of it. But one thing you learn in mathematics is not to trust models until you have a proof. Newton said that it was only possible to get 12 to touch. And he was debating this with the astronomer Gregory, who said it was possible to get 13 to touch. Well, it turns out Newton was right and Gregory was wrong. It is not possible to get 13 to touch. These are all illusions. This is just a computer graphic fuzzy picture. This is a styrofoam model where the styrofoam balls have been crushed so that they fit in and touch the ones in the middle. This is a wood model, but if you shake it, you can hear the rattle of the ball in the center. So it's possible to get 12 to touch. It's almost possible to get 13 to touch, but it was finally settled in the 1950s that it's impossible to actually get this 13th sphere to touch the one in the middle. Let me say why this problem is hard. If I start out with a random sphere packing, you have to show that the cannonball arrangement is the best one, which means that you have to show that all possible other arrangements are worse. And if you take this and pack them down so they can't move anymore. You get one arrangement, and if you mix them up again and pack them down again, you'll get another good arrangement. And I don't have any conception of how many possible good arrangements that you can get by mixing them up and pushing them down until they don't move anymore. I don't know whether it's millions or billions or what, even with just a small number of balls like 100. But let me say that in calculus, you learn to do an optimization like this. You have something that you're trying to optimize, and you're given certain, what you do is you take the derivative and set it equal to zero, and you find, and then you check these points and you find out which one's best. But when I have something like this fish tank full of balls, there are hundreds of, well, there's 100 balls or so, and who knows how many possibilities. So the optimization problem is going to look something more like this. And what you are taught to do in calculus is just completely ineffective when you're faced with a large number of possibilities. Let me say a few words about the solution. In my mind, there are two main ingredients to the solution that made it possible. The first was designing a new kind of box to hold the cannonballs. This right here is one example of the type of box that I used in my solution. I didn't finish this model. You should actually imagine one of these things stuck in the middle of this, so just big enough to hold the cannonball. And this is one possible puzzle piece or box, and one of the main steps of the proof was to design about 5,000 different boxes with the property that any good packing, no matter how strange it looked, had to contain lots and lots of these boxes. Okay. So the design of the new type of box was one of the most difficult parts of the solution. The other part that I think was very critical was finding that this solution was governed by linear equations. When you start designing boxes, you replace very rapidly, you don't talk about the cannonballs anymore, you start talking about these tiles and these different pieces that fit together. And what you find is that when you no longer have spheres, but shapes like this, all the equations become linear. Nonlinear problems are extremely difficult to solve, but you have a bunch of linear equations that describe these shapes, and you have constraints showing how these pieces fit together. Those are all linear equations. And you can solve linear equations very rapidly. Let me just show you one example. I promise no equations, but here's a typical file. I have maybe 150 variables and 2,000 equations describing one possible box, and there are all these thousands of boxes. And then I do a linear optimization, because these are all linear equations. This is about a 20-page file. And the computer on my desktop can solve this in a few seconds without any difficulty. So once you replace the nonlinear equations by linear equations, the solution can come very rapidly. Of course, when you turn to computers, you worry about errors. The referees are still checking my proof. I received the following email. There is an error in your proof on page 249, and a bug in your code in gigabyte sector 5. Other than that, I think your proof is more credible than the Berkeley proof. There's a Berkeley professor who claimed to have proved this problem in 1990. The experts never accepted his solution. But he's now writing a book on his proof, and he's never backed down. So there's a bit of a controversy there. So I've finished now with the main part of my talk, the part on cannonballs, I didn't want people to think that all of these old conjectures have the solution that you expect. And so I'm going to say a little bit about another problem, foam, here at the end. And if you take these boxes and you pack them together and take away the boxes, then you're left with the cannonball packing. But if you take these boxes without the cannonballs in them and pack them together, you just have the boundaries of these pieces filling up space. And if you make these faces soft, then you have something that looks very much like a foam rather than a cannonball packing. So you've gone from a very hard problem to a very soft problem that's very closely related to the one that you start out with. So the final topics, I'm going to talk a little bit about the honeycomb problem, which is the two-dimensional problem, the Kelvin problem, which is the three-dimensional problem. I'm going to describe an example, and then I'll move to a conclusion. So this honeycomb shape, I can think of it as a sphere packing problem, and this is the best possible sphere packing. But if I look at the boxes around the spheres instead, then I have a hexagonal grid, and you get quite a different problem there. The problem there is to show that the way to divide up the plane into regions of equal area is obtained by this hexagonal pattern. The best way to do it, meaning the smallest perimeter, is obtained in this way. Okay, so the honeycomb problem is to show that the honeycomb is the best way to divide the plane into cells of equal area. As I understand it, this is actually an unsolved problem in mathematics. It's just incredible to me that it hasn't been solved, but they've solved it under very restrictive hypotheses, but the general problem is still unsolved, and it goes back to antiquity in certain respects. People were talking already about packing together triangles and squares and hexagons and saying that the hexagonal packing was best. So here's a good unsolved problem that, I feel people must have just forgotten about it or something, because I can't imagine it's that difficult a problem, but it hasn't been solved. So in three dimensions, when you strip away and you make the cells soft instead of hard, you get a foam in space. And the corresponding problem in three dimensions is also unsolved. You want to put together volumes, equal volumes, in such a way that you minimize the surface of the cells. This is how far we are on solving the problem. This was done by a few researchers a few years ago. They solved the problem when you have two boxes or two cells, two pieces of foam. This is called the double bubble problem. And they showed that this is the best way to break up space into two equal volumes in a surface minimizing way. The interesting thing about the solution is that it was also a computer solution. It relied on interval arithmetic, which is one of the methods that I used a great deal in the proof of Kepler conjecture. So there are certain points of contact in the method of proof. So the three-dimensional problem has a conjectural answer, which is, this was obtained by Lord Kelvin. He said, take these things and pack them together, so you tile with these pieces. To see that these things tile, if I hold it this way, you see that I get an octagon. Everybody see the octagon? So octagons, well, they almost tile space, but you get these squares that are left out. But if you notice that this octagon has a square right here in front, and that plugs the hole so that you can build up layers of these things to fill space. So here's the second layer plugging the hole. And Kelvin said that he thought that this arrangement was the solution to the problem, that if you want to pack equal volumes in a surface minimizing way, you should use this. And to prove his point, he made a set of bed springs illustrating the arrangement. You really have to look carefully. So this was actually constructed by Lord Kelvin. It's in a museum now. But if you look very carefully, you can see that's one of the squares, for instance, that corresponds to a square in this diagram. So people believed for a long time that this was the best way to pack cells together. Hermann Weyl, for instance, in his book on symmetry, says that he was inclined to believe that this is the best possible arrangement. But two physicists shocked the mathematicians a few years ago when they constructed a counterexample to Kelvin's conjecture. Two physicists are Felin and Ware, and what they did with their so this is a picture of it, and here's a model of it. They used two different types of cells that have the same volume, and it takes a while to see, but you can fit these things together. I put, for each yellow box, I put a whole bunch of these things around it, and they fit together around the yellow box, and then I can continue out and fill space with these things. And they have the same volume, but you get a smaller surface when you do it with this construction than with this. So this really took mathematicians by surprise. But now nobody has any idea what the correct answer should be, because they don't dare conjecture that they found the best possible answer. They just know that what Kelvin thought was good is not so good. So this is the Kelvin problem. I don't know if you've noticed, I've been putting stars by these problems, saying how good a problem I think they are. And this is a 10-star problem to show that the surface minimizing way to break space into cells of equal volume. You want to determine the best way to do that. I should say that Kelvin called this thing a tetrachidecahedron. And everybody has condemned Kelvin ever since for that term. Coxer calls it an outrageous thing to call this, and perhaps that's, maybe it was doomed to die according to a counterexample. So I want to conclude with a few words about Hilbert and his problems. Hilbert, in 1900, produced a list of problems where that have been extremely influential in 20th century mathematics. And his idea was that these should be problems that are easy to state, problems that anybody could understand, that you really aren't explaining your theory until you can explain it to somebody in the street. So that was 1900. Now we're coming onto a new century. And everybody has a list of problems that they want to make for the new Hilbert problems. I'm sure most of the mathematicians in this audience have their favorite problems that they'd like to see on the list for the 21st century. But I'm giving a lecture today, so I'm going to propose one, and that is the Kelvin problem. I think it's a really great problem. It's very simple to state. You're just packing equal volumes in a surface minimizing way. It's easy to understand. And so if Kepler's problem, which was included on the 18th of Hilbert's problem, is to be replaced by another problem, it'd be my preference to see Kelvin's problem there. So this is just what Hilbert said as part of his 18th problem. The 18th problem is a long problem with several parts to it. So at the end, I'd just like to give credit to a couple of people. On the right is Sam Ferguson, a graduate student who helped me a great deal with this project. His thesis solved an important step in the solution of this problem, and he helped me a great deal with the computer work as well. And on the left, I'm there in the middle, and then on the left is Sean McLaughlin, the undergraduate who proved this, what's called the dodecahedral conjecture, that this shape gives the smallest possible volume for a box in a sphere packing. So I'll just close with a statement that sphere packer Neil Sloan made at the International Congress last year. In short, many beautiful packings have been discovered, but there are few proofs that any of them are optimal. And that gives a challenge to all of us to prove some theorems corresponding to all these conjectures. And another person involved in sphere packing, Laszlo Fejes Tott, he spoke about the sphere packing problem, but then he spoke about another problem called the covering problem, which is very closely related to this Kelvin problem. And he said still worse are the prospects of solving the covering problem. And yet we have a hope that the human heart is strong and will to strive to seek to find and not to yield. So I think I've explained all my models now. Is that all?